Welcome. This is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and a prolific author. Specific to our conversation today is Brian's book, Floods, Famines, and Emperors, El Niño, and the Fate of Civilizations. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, thank you.
We know you're 3 years into writing a new book about fishing, so this afternoon we appreciate your shifting with us into the flow of the ocean current known as El Niño. What is El Niño?
El Niño is a global phenomenon. It is not a local thing, which people thought for years. And back in the 1920s, they finally identified that this was a global phenomenon. It is a pressure imbalance down in the Southwest Pacific, which causes warm water to cascade across the Pacific towards the Americas, and owing to a lot of still very little understood interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere, it really affects global weather very profoundly, especially when you have a severe El Niño, as they are now forecasting for this year.
Right. And this oscillation has been going on for many thousands of years.
It's been going on for a very long time. We don't exactly know how long, but certainly I would think 10,000 years or more since the Ice Age. It's quite well documented back at least 5,000 or 6,000 years before Christ. So it's been around a while.
Yeah, my ancient friends in Southwest Pacific, where you speak of, tell me that when this dance of currents and the winds reverses, they blend with this event and get in their voyaging canoes and travel back the way they came.
Yep. Oh, yeah. That's very much part of the tradition. When the trade winds are down, people tended to travel east. Yes, that's a little-known aspect of El Niño, actually.
Yeah, they talk about it in their oral history. What's the origin of the name El Niño?
Back in the 19th century, there was a flourishing trade in bird guano, bird droppings from the Peruvian coast,
right,
which produced a very nitrogen-rich fertilizer, which in the days before artificial fertilizers was a huge export industry for the new nation of Peru. And they found at times that the seabirds who provided the droppings vanished. And eventually research was done, and they talked to the fishermen who pointed out that there was a countercurrent which came and brought tropical fish and the anchovies, which nourished not only the seabirds, but ancient Andean civilizations, were decimated. And then it resumed. And they called this El Niño, the Christmas child, because it normally traditionally kicked in at about Christmas and brought with it heavy rain and quite uncharacteristic climatic conditions for one of the driest coasts in the world.
And you mentioned the anchovies off that coast. What happens to the fish, and particularly the anchovies, when an El Niño is running?
Oh, they move elsewhere. They move further south into colder water. Because like all animals and plants, they're sensitive to climatic change. And the water warms up. I mean, in Santa Barbara here at the moment, we've got very, very high water temperatures, about 70 degrees, which for us is very, very warm indeed. And we've got tropical fish like and hammerhead sharks up here, which is very unusual. So all the signs are that we are in the early stages of a major El Niño.
And our ability to measure these temperatures in different locations in the Pacific is very significant to us at this time. Can you tell us why that's significant?
Well, what's happened is that back in the 1920s and around then, when they first identified this, the only temperatures they had were either in weather stations on land or in ships. What we have now are automated ocean buoys and satellites, which are providing astronomically large quantities of data from which they construct models of changing temperature and climate. And this is a huge advance which has happened in the last 20 to 30 years. which is transforming our knowledge of El Niños as a global phenomenon. And with all the interest now in global warming and so on, and the fact that we now know how severe the damage done by drought and too much rain by large El Niños, it's become a major research topic. And the area where we know the least is the very complex relationship between the ocean and the atmosphere, which causes so many of the phenomena associated with El Niño.
But this ocean-atmosphere oscillation is the dynamic that's driving El Niño.
Yeah, it's been described by one very gifted scientist as a kind of minuet between two partners who are one is slow and the other one's fast, which is very true. And this is really fascinating stuff.
Well, we certainly know now that we've got those temperature readings. We've got a predictive handle on when an El Niño is coming. It's not an unexpected shocking event the way it could have been for fishermen who were surprised to see the water get warm and everybody leave.
This is so. It's like hurricanes. We've now got extraordinarily complex predictive tools, forecasts, if you like, which really enable us to map the expansion of an El Niño from when it is born. And in fact, with the present one, which of course the media with their usual hysterics have called Godzilla, they will literally be able to track this for months and every little detail of it, like the trade winds going down and all that. So we really know far more and have far more warning than anyone in the past has, where the most you would probably get 24, 48 hours, with of course the warming and the fish distribution is giving you warning that something big was coming.
Right. And so as the ocean heats up and the landmass heats up and the atmosphere heats up, the network of currents and reversals seem to speed up. Do El Niños seem to be coming more frequently and more severely?
This is one of the most interesting things. You really can't predict. The thing about climate is that it is totally irregular, and things happen unpredictably. What we have now is, a much better perspective on ancient El Niños and their frequency, and B, much more information about predicting future climate. There are experts who are saying we're going to see more El Niños. There are others who will say we're going to see less. But whatever they will be irregular. We're perfectly capable of getting two major El Niños one after the other, or having a quite long period like we've just had, where we haven't had one for, it must be about 15 years of any significance. So really, it's really unpredictable.
Although we know everything's interconnected and interdependent, we're largely educated as a population to look at two-dimensional maps, and we can overlook the depth of the ocean and the height of the space above us. And until recently, nobody paid a whole lot of attention to the atmosphere and the sun and the great mind currents. So we got kind of a cavalier attitude, unless we're shocked and surprised by an event of Mother Nature. But what I hear you saying is that we've got a handle on this, and we shouldn't be shocked and surprised. We might want to get back in connection with what's going on with nature.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the most striking things about ancient societies is the astounding amount of information they had on the environment around them. For example, if you take the Aleutian Islanders up in Alaska, they had, I believe, something like 20 different words which explain the nuances of the wind alone.
Yes.
And I've walked with African farmers through their fields, and they've told me the different grasses, what they do when they come into season, when they can graze them, those that are poisonous, and so on. Their information about the environment is far more intimate than ours. And we, in a way, are remote from it. We're insulated from it. Where we have information is from science.
Right.
And we've got a lot to learn from traditional knowledge.
I agree. You know, the people I referred to earlier, the Waitaha people in New Zealand, tell me that this oscillation of currents and the atmosphere is how Mother Nature tries to maintain balance.
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes. And there is a lot of oral tradition around the world about the living environment and balance and cycles and so on. Oh, yeah. That's well established in many societies.
This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Brian Fagan about the building heat in the Pacific, the El Nino current, and what history can teach us about possible events that may be approaching in the near future. So El Nino impacts not only fishing, but results in some places in big rains, flooding, devastation of homes, roads, agricultural crops, and irrigation systems. Talk about some of the history you detail in your book.
My book is kind of out of date. It's been around a while. There's so much new research. But basically, what you've got are, firstly, many fewer people in the world. And that is, population is a huge kind of silent elephant in this whole story, which we consistently, even now, ignore. The big difference is that you've got people who are, in many parts of the world, subsistence farmers. For example, the Maya of Central America ultimately depended on subsistence agriculture. And if you get a cycle of drought, which drought incidents which last 50 years, you're going to have serious problems with productivity, feeding people, and so on. And in fact, that is one of the things that really caused major problems for the Maya. What is less well known is that in California, 1,000 years ago, there were 100-year droughts, and now we're complaining about 4-year droughts. Of course, and in a different world, where now there are millions of people. And in the past, many societies simply could move. They could move to more permanent water supplies and so on. And they were much more flexible than we are. But there's a long record in history of ancient civilizations being devastated or damaged by droughts, many of them caused by El Niños.
Right. And you, in your book, begin to speak particularly intensely at the end about the effect in societies under an unwise relationship with their environment and leadership disconnected from nature, that El Niño can deliver a knockout punch to that culture and nation.
Oh, yeah. In the past, it's very interesting. If you go down into coastal Peru, there were societies which really had problems. One of them was a very flamboyant river valley state called the Moche, which in the first millennium A.D. Was ruled by a series of kind of dynastic families who were warrior priests. And these people presided over an agricultural society, as well as living on anchovies. They irrigated rivers which were watered by water from the Andes Ocean, runoff from the Andes. And these irrigation schemes, when you had 100-year rainfall, really big El Nino, within a few hours you could lose hundreds of acres of irrigated land. And these people had preached they were gods and so on, and that they controlled nature, or words to that effect. And until recently, we thought, this is what caused many of these pyramids and big centers to collapse, and there's evidence of this sort of thing. But in fact, in recent years, they found evidence that the leaders were aware of these El Niños, although they were powerless to stop them, and they indulge, among other things, in human sacrifice to presumably propitiate the supernatural forces responsible for this. But the civilization was damaged severely by a series of El Niños. On the other hand, another civilization somewhat later called the Chimú, who were before the Inca on the coast, they were very clever because they irrigated different valleys, they connected them, they stored water, they developed defenses and managed to survive some pretty severe El Niños. It really depends on the flexibility of the leadership.
Yeah, you make the point quite strongly that the greatest danger from El Nino to humanity can be a destruction of people's faith in the legitimacy of their leadership and the foundations of their society.
Yes, and if you take someone like the Egyptian pharaohs, for example, the very early pharaohs preached that they were divine, that they were gods. And then there was a a long period of drought in the Nile, some of which probably caused by El Nino conditions, where the people turned around to the pharaohs and said, good afternoon, where's food? And the pharaohs didn't have it. And for something like 100 years, Egypt fell apart into different parts. This was about 2100 BC, somewhere around there.
Right.
But the later pharaohs who reunified the kingdom and kept it going for 2,000 years preached instead that they were shepherds of the people, which is a very different thing, and invested heavily in grain storage. And the civilization survived despite droughts for 2,000 more years. Some of these people learned, others didn't.
Well, and so to try and connect this with the relevance of where we're at today, I shared with you a line from a man named Theodor Schwenk, and he told us that a way of thinking directed solely to profit cannot perceive the vital coherence of all things in nature. And much of our news is about our economy and how business is doing, but we never want to take our eye off Mother Nature.
I think you want to not take your eye off a large number of things. The first one is that we are ultimately powerless in the face of nature, environmental forces. We are powerless ultimately in the face of earthquakes, tsunamis, catastrophic floods, major El Ninos, and probably more than almost any other, rising sea levels. Because one of the major elephants in our environmental room is firstly, or two, one is warming, and anyone who says that global warming now is not connected with human activity is just plain in denial, or if you want it in blunt terms, dumb, because it's clearly having an effect, and it's accelerating. But the biggest one in the longer term is rising sea levels. If you look at the Netherlands, or you look at Miami Beach, or you look at Shanghai, or you look at Bangladesh, where within 50 years they're going to have to move millions of people from their land, which is at sea level. And in a situation where there's nobody to go, where to go, one of the great, great problems of the next century, in my humble opinion, is that of environmental refugees. And that will make the migration problems in Europe at the moment and elsewhere look insignificant. Where do you put millions of subsistence farmers from Bangladesh who have no familiarity, basically, with the industrial world? And you've got problems like that coming, and at the moment there is almost no international concern or thinking about it. And to think of expansion, use of more and more resources and so on, in contexts like this is, I think, very short-sighted. Because the biggest problem with anything with environmental change, and we know this from El Nino history and other climatic history, is that you really have to think of these things not in terms of our children or, goodness help us, the next election. You have to think of these things in the context of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, because we really have got to make decisions now for future generations, not for us, but for future generations. And this is in a world full of people who think short-term, which America is very good at doing, is frightening. The countries that are most in front on this one are some in Europe who are really very concerned, and I think Australia and New Zealand are doing a lot of thinking about it, and others. But this, to me, is the biggest problem facing humanity, the need to think long-term and to plan altruistically, not just for America or New Zealand or Sweden, but for the whole of humanity. And an awful lot of humanity is very poor, very hungry, and in numbers, in the millions. That all sounds rather extreme, but I think that's a fairly realistic statement.
Well, I think your sobering message is right on. And
this is something we've got to take very seriously, but we show no signs of it, or very few.
Well, and that's, I think disconnection is the health tragedy of our time. And when you're disconnected, you can get focused on irrelevant or secondary information and behavior.
The media are absolutely brilliant at providing distractive, irrelevant information. We live in a world of trivia. This is not a trivial issue.
Well,
and all you've got to do is look back to the 1998 El Nino and the impact it had on California and Peru, northeast Brazil, Australia, New Guinea. I mean, there were big famines in New Guinea coming along because of drought in Highland New Guinea. People just aren't aware of this. But they're all aware of what the latest celebrity is doing,
right,
which is nonsense.
And so leadership and preparation are key to what's coming, and we don't know how severe or how big or exactly the timing, but all the scientific information is telling us that we've got a short-term El Nino event that we can either be prepared for or surprised by.
Yes, but the good news is that a great deal of pretty intelligent preparation is being done. I mean, many of the cities in California on the coast are actively clearing drains and things like that. In Peru, there's a great deal done to prepare in terms of crops planted and so on. So there is a lot happening. The biggest challenge is an interesting one. It is creating styles of long-term leadership which transcend national boundaries and trivial religious pursuits, which deal with the very, very fundamental problems facing humanity. And that's a problem that I don't know how we solve it.
Well,
that and population.
From our experience here in America with Katrina, people know the price of feeble leadership out of touch with nature. And your book is full of examples where inadequate preparation had tragic results.
Yeah, and of course the other thing that's going on is that you do have, one of the most interesting lessons out of Katrina was really the power of ties of kin and neighborhood and family and community organizations, among them churches, who were enormously helpful and productive in the recovery from Katrina, uneven as it had been. But you're absolutely correct. We don't put any time into really thinking about this sort of thing.
Right. And when you were listing some of the variables that can come with this, my Waitaha friends tell me that their oral history, which goes back many, many thousands of years, says that after El Nino, the Pacific Ring of Fire can see increased volcanic activity.
That I have no idea about.
Well, it's just another variable in those ones you enumerated.
I mean, remember that 73,000 years ago, which geologically isn't a long time, Mount Toba in Indonesia blew up and cast ash all over India.
Right.
Or over much of it, and must have caused extraordinary devastation. Fortunately, there weren't so many people living in the world. Imagine if that happened today.
Right.
And one day it will.
Yes.
Probably not in our lifetimes, I hope, but one day it will.
So tell us a little bit what's being done to prepare in Santa Barbara.
I'm not really on top of it. I just come back from Europe. I've been away. What is happening? They're clearing storm drains, checking watersheds, making sure that highways are clear, getting ready to deal with mud slides. They have started a handout of free sandbags and things like that. A lot of it's local. A lot of this stuff really is local. What do you do about sea level change in, say, Seattle? And you have to think of local solutions because it's all very well having national ones. But really, a lot of these problems are local because nobody knows what the problems of Santa Barbara are better than Santa Barbara.
Right. Well, this has been helpful. Thank you, Brian.
My pleasure.
This is William Evans. You've been listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Brian Fagan about the El Nino current, and its historical consequences for emperors, nations, and its potential impact in our near future. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.
One heart, one love, we're all one people.